Thank you. Good morning and welcome to this presentation of the full year result for Infigen Energy for the 12 months ended 30 June 2013. I'm Miles George, the Managing Director of Infigen, and joining me today to present the result is Chris Babystock, our Chief Financial Officer, and Richie Farrell, our Investor Relations Manager. The agenda for this presentation is set out on slide 2 of the pack released with our result. I'll briefly address the key outcomes outlined in the early slides, followed by Chris on the group's financial performance, and then I'll discuss the operational performance at a regional level. Later on, I'll provide a brief update on the regulatory and market environment, the outlook for the business, and our priorities. We'll then open the floor and the line for questions. During the Q&A session, I would ask that initial call participants ask only one question to allow all participants an opportunity to ask their question. If there's time after this, additional or follow-up questions can be asked. Turning then to slide 3, the performance overview. The key financial highlights from an economic perspective, economic interest perspective, are outlined on the right-hand side of this chart. The performance of the business during the year was solid, primarily due to revenue growth of 7% or 19.5 million dollars, underpinned by higher electricity prices in Australia and the United States, and higher production and compensated revenue in Australia. Operating costs were flat year-on-year, notwithstanding the additional costs associated with Woodlawn Wind Farm's first full year of operation. Both the U.S. and Australia recorded wind farm operating costs below the lower end of guidance ranges previously advised to the market. Other costs were broadly in line with the prior corresponding period, with the exception of corporate costs, which were up 2.6 million to 14.1 million, as expected, due to the non-recurrence of incentive write-backs that were booked in the prior period. At an underlying level, corporate costs included a net 0.7 million reduction realized as part of the previously announced cost reduction initiative. As a result, Infigen delivered strong EBITDA of 158.2 million dollars, up 13% or 17.7 million dollars. This outcome drove a 36% increase in net operating cash flow to 84.2 million dollars. Infigen repaid 57.5 million dollars of global facility debt ahead of its 55 million dollar guidance, contributed $13.9 million cash to reducing its U.S. institutional equity partnership Class A capital balance liabilities, and repaid $1.5 million of its Woodlawn project finance facility. Infigen reported a $34.3 million improvement in its net loss after tax and before impairments of $21.6 million, compared to a net loss after tax of $55.9 million in the prior period. As announced last week, Infigen recorded a one-off impairment expense of 58.4 million Australian dollars related to its U.S. cash-generating unit, which is reflected in the statutory net loss. Turning to slide 4, our operating capacity remained the same during the year, although this year was the first full year of production from the 48-megawatt Woodlawn Wind Farm in Australia. Total production increased 2%, largely due to better availability, higher compensated production in Australia, and a full year of Woodlawn production, partially offset by lost production from Gamesa blade failures in the U.S. Wind conditions and network and weather-related constraints were mixed. Revenue increased 7% due to higher electricity prices, higher production, including a full year of Woodlawn revenue, and higher compensated revenue, partially offset by a weaker marginal loss factor in Australia. Operating costs were flat. Increases associated with a full year of Woodlawn costs, inflation, and higher fixed post-warranty contract costs were offset by lower component replacement costs. The increase in corporate development and other costs largely reflected the non-recurring LTI write-back in the prior corresponding period, as I mentioned previously, lower development costs, and an initial net benefit following the cost reduction initiative. EBITDA increased 13%, reflecting the strong revenue growth and flat operating costs. Below the EBITDA line, we recorded higher net income from US institutional equity partnerships and a lower net interest expense, partially offset by higher amortization of loan fees and FX losses and a lower tax benefit. Chris will speak to these items in more detail shortly. Infogen reported a $34.3 million improvement to its net loss after tax and before impairments of $21.6 million compared to a net loss of $55.5 million in the prior period. The net loss of $80 million included an impairment expense, as I mentioned, of $58.3 million Aussie dollars for the US cash generating unit. I'll now hand over to Chris Bavistock, our Chief Financial Officer, to discuss further the group's financial performance.
Thanks, Miles. By way of lead-in, slide 6 sets out the summary statutory P&L and associated metrics, and slide 7 sets out a reconciliation between the statutory and economic interest presentation of the P&L. On to slide 7, which will be familiar to those who have attended our past presentations. This slide bridges the statutory view to economic interest. Currently, this only involves non-controlling interest in two USA wind farms, where our Class B controlling interest exceeds 50% and is less than 100%. While Infogen naturally continues to prepare the group's financial statements on a fully IFRS-compliant basis, we remain of the view that an economic interest or proportionally consolidated perspective is the most meaningful one and reflects the way in which the group internally manages its financials. This is also apparent from our segment information disclosure in our consolidated financial statements in Note 2. From here on, the presentation for all financials will be on an economic interest basis. As for other briefings, I will draw your attention to our management discussion and analysis, MD&A, which supplements this presentation. Slide 8 sets out the summary economic interest P&L and associated metrics. Below the EBITDA level, the principal observations are the impairment expense of the US CGU was by far the largest contributor to the statutory net loss. Net borrowing costs were slightly higher due to higher amortization of loan fees and non-cash decommissioning costs, offset by lower interest expense resulting from the reduction in debt. A FX and interest rate revaluation expense arose due to the depreciation of the AUD against the USD and Euro, offset by the benefit from the step down in the notional value of interest rate swaps and an increase in the value of an FX option. Net income from our US IEPs, that's the Institutional Equity Partnerships, increased by approximately $20 million, primarily reflecting the unwinding of the benefits deferred. This occurs with the unwinding for accounts purposes over 25 years, whilst the tax benefit received was over the initial 5 years. Tax, whilst principally a non-cash item due to the availability of tax losses, benefited more this year due to the effect of unrealised foreign exchange movements. Turning to slide 9. This sets out the revenue bridge. The full year outcome was published in our Q4 production and revenue report released at the end of July. While the audit was in progress at that time, the amounts have not changed since then. Revenue increased 7% year on year, and the principal features were as follows. Price was the major year on year variance, with Australia contributing an additional $13.6 million and the US an additional $1.4 million. Higher production contributed an additional $4.9 million, with $6.8 million additional contribution from Australia being partially offset by $1.9 million lower contribution from the US. Our analysis has now been enhanced to separate the impact of marginal loss factor revisions from production. For FY13, these were adverse in Australia. This was offset by an increased compensated revenue in Australia with a delta over prior year of $2.5 million. Average FX rates were around the same as the previous year, resulting in no FX variance. Slide 10 sets out the EBITDA bridge. Revenue variances are presented in aggregate and were addressed on the previous slide. From a cost perspective, the major variances were as follows. At the headline level, corporate costs increased 3.3% due to the non-cash incentive and employee benefit write-backs that were identified in the FY12 result as non-recurring. Underlying operating costs before the FX benefit increased $0.6 million, with higher costs associated with a full year from Woodlawn in Australia and CPI-linked contracts, partially offset by lower component replacement costs in the US. There were lower development expenses in the US and Australia of 0.6 and 0.4 respectively, as the pipelines increasingly mature. the organisation restructure and cost reduction initiative that will deliver $7 million per annum cash benefit from FY14 achieved a $0.8 million net benefit in FY13 after restructure costs, slightly ahead of our expectation for the year. Slide 11 reconciles operating EBITDA to net operating cash flow for FY12 and 13. FY13 net operating cash flow of $84.2 million was $22.1 million, or 36% up on FY12. This outcome was driven by two factors, being, firstly, the flow-through from the higher operating EBITDA, offset by the slightly higher corporate and development costs, and secondly, the reduction in financing costs and tax paid, with the financing component reflecting the benefits from debt amortization. Slide 12 summarizes the FY12 to 13 movement in cash, as well as identifying the cash balance held outside the bank group. The primary inflows for net operating cash flow were at $84 million. Unrealized FX gains from cash held in foreign currencies resulted in an additional $8 million in AUD terms at the balance date. $57 million was directed towards repayment of the global facility, with $2 million of the Woodlawn project finance facility also repaid. $14 million was used to repay the US Institutional Equity Partnership Class A capital balances. This will progressively increase over the coming years as Infogen's capital balances are paid down and cash flow is directed to repaying Class A members. $21 million of PP&E and intangible outflow. PP&E of $11 million was consistent with FY12 after allowing for the turbine replacement at Allegheny and the construction of the Capital East solar demo in Australia. Intangibles expenditure of $10 million was on progressing our development pipelines in both Australia and the US, including the US solar projects Wildwood and Pump Jack, which secured PPAs during the year. Slide 13 sets out the impact of FX on the P&L and on the principal balance sheet liabilities. From a P&L perspective, there were relatively minor net favorable impact of FX of $1.2 million for the year. The translation of foreign currency borrowings and Class A IEP balances at balance date has resulted in an unfavorable movement in AUD terms due to the depreciation of the AUD against the USD and euro. There were also significant FX movements across other categories of the balance sheet, particularly PP&E and intangibles. These movements are identified in the notes to the accounts. Slide 14 gives the balance sheet. The principal features are a marginal reduction in net debt, EBITDA, largely a result of higher EBITDA and debt amortization, partially offset by the FX translation of foreign currency denominated borrowings, and gearing has increased largely as a result of the reduction in net assets following the impairment of the US CGU. This concludes the financial results part of the presentation, and I now hand back to Miles for a review of the operations in each region.
Thanks, Chris. Turning firstly to our safety performance on slide 16. Over the last 12 months, we've maintained our lost time injury frequency rate of 1.2. As reported at our interim result, we regrettably had a lost time injury in January, having briefly achieved our goal of zero harm. We remain firmly committed to pursuing zero harm and reducing our LTIFR, and we continue to introduce new initiatives and to enhance existing programs to assist with achieving that goal. Moving now to slide 17. Wind conditions remain subdued in FY13. Gamesa blade failures, lower average wind speeds and weather and network constraints were partially offset by improved availability at some sites and higher production due to favourable scheduling of maintenance during lower wind periods. Slightly lower production and REC prices were partially offset by higher compensated revenue and higher electricity prices, translating to a 1% reduction in US revenue. Electricity market conditions in the US are showing small signs of improvement, but remain subdued. Due to the contracted nature of our assets, with 86% under PPAs during FY13, an average price of around $44.80 per megawatt hour, excluding PTCs, was 3% higher than the prior year. Operating costs decreased 3% in FY13, reflecting lower component replacement costs and legal fees. During the year, we settled long-standing disputes with Gamesa and executed 15-year warranty maintenance and services agreements that provide minimum availability guarantees. Moving on to slide 18, our operating costs in the US for FY13, with Infogen asset management costs now also included, were $74.8 million, 1% $1.7 million below the lower end of the guidance range. The primary movements were lower turbine O&M costs due to lower component replacement costs and some lower balance of plant costs, partially offset by higher fixed costs associated with the extended warranty agreements. We continue with our predictive and preventative maintenance measures and direct sourcing of components where possible at the sites where Infogen is exposed to the cost of component replacement. The chart on the right shows the percentage of our US fleet covered by warranty, service and maintenance agreements, the percentage of the fleet where Infogen Asset Management is undertaking the service and maintenance, and the balance where the service and maintenance is contracted to third parties. In the first category, where the third party is responsible for the cost of component replacement, the fixed fee is higher than the two latter categories where component replacements are at Infogen's expense. As we look further out, we have opportunities to either further contract these services to third parties or undertake them internally, and we continue to use competitive tendering as a cost containment strategy. Turning to Australia on slide 19, production in Australia was up 8% compared to the prior financial year due to better wind conditions in Western Australia and New South Wales, lower network constraints, a full year of production from Woodlawn, improved availability and compensated production, offset by some poor wind at Lake Bonnie. Improved site availability was largely due to Woodlawn being fully operational for the entire year and decreased unplanned servicing and outages at Capital Wind Farm. Revenue increased 16% or $20.5 million, reflecting higher average prices, higher production, higher compensated and other revenue, partially offset by unfavourable marginal loss factors compared to the prior year. The 5% operating cost increase is largely attributable to a full year of Woodlawn and inflation-linked contracts. We achieved an average price of almost $97 a megawatt hour, 8% higher than the prior year as a result of higher wholesale electricity prices, partially offset by lower LGC prices. On a per megawatt hour basis, operating costs decreased 4%. Turning to slide 20, in absolute cost terms, our wind farm operating costs increased $1.3 million in Australia, of which about half is attributable to a full year of Woodlawn operations. Legal costs incurred in relation to the settlement of the dispute with the Australian Electricity Market Operator, AEMO, scheduling error, and the end of warranty inspection costs at Lake Bonnie accounted for the asset management increases. After accounting for Woodlawn turbine O&M costs, for the balance of the fleet were marginally down as lower component replacement costs offset higher fixed costs associated with post-warranty maintenance agreements. Inflation-linked contracts accounted for the remainder of the variance. Energy market costs increased by $0.3 million, largely due to increased compliance obligations under our various retail and financial licences and regulatory schemes. As the chart on the bottom left shows, we have reduced our exposure to variability in post-warranty costs, and we have further opportunities to reduce this exposure as further original warranties roll off. Turning on to slide 22 and the market update for the US. While US regulation and market prices have some effect on our business, it's important to note that following the expiry of the Crescent Ridge PPA during the year, our US asset portfolio still has 80% of its output contracted, with the remaining weighted average contract duration of 11.5 years. This significantly insulates the portfolio from the current low spot electricity prices in that country. The new build signal for all forms of electricity generation have been weakened by low natural gas prices, but increasing demand, reduced capacity investment, continuing retirement of coal-fired power stations, and increasing natural gas forward prices are expected to tighten capacity reserves and lift prices in the medium term. This is reflected in independent long-term electricity price modeling. Infigen's current average realized price is approximately $45 per megawatt hour before PTCs, and we expect to benefit from the higher electricity and REC prices when existing PPAs roll off in the long term. PJM market REC prices are forecast to rise significantly as renewable targets increase, while ERCOT, that's the Texas market, REC prices are expected to remain subdued due to significant oversupply of renewable energy in that market. The Federal Production Tax Credit Scheme has been renewed for new wind farm developments that begin construction prior to the end of 2013, while the investment tax credit for solar development remains in place until December 2016, with healthy demand for solar PV projects under state-based renewable portfolio standards. Turning to the Australian regulatory update on slide 23, we've highlighted again the growing opportunity for renewable energy in Australia, driven by the large-scale renewable energy target legislation. Regulatory uncertainty remains, notwithstanding the Climate Change Authority's positive recommendations and findings from its review of the renewable energy target in late 2012 and the government's endorsement of those findings. With an upcoming federal election, incumbent fossil fuel generators are strongly lobbying to reduce the renewable energy target to protect their commercial interests. But independent modelling shows that households and businesses would be worse off under a reduced renewable energy target. The existing surplus of LGCs can absorb small deficits until approximately 2017, but the deficits begin to grow dramatically from 2015 onwards and can only be met through new renewable energy generation investment. 3 to 4 gigawatts of new capacity will need to be installed between now and 2017 to meet the impending shortfall in 2018 alone. Beyond that, 1.5 to 2 gigawatts of new capacity per annum will be required to keep pace with the increasing annual targets to 2020. The targets are challenging but achievable, and liable entities will need to underwrite investments in long-life renewable energy assets required in order to meet their long-term obligations at least cost. The Clean Energy Finance Corporation and the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, or ARENA, have also been playing an active role in building momentum in renewable energy investments in Australia. Turning to slide 24, the government plans to bring forward the floating carbon price linked to the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme a year earlier to 1 July 2014, and the opposition coalition has stated that they will repeal the carbon price if elected. The market is pricing in a lower carbon price in 2015. In calendar 2016, the expected step up to export price parity gas prices on the east coast of Australia is also evident in the forward projections. LGC forwards have dropped throughout FY13, reflecting illiquidity, uncertainty, and a lower cost of carriers as a result of lower interest rates. Spot LGC availability continues to decline, resulting in limited ability for obligated parties to meet their obligations for 2017 onwards from the existing surplus. Fundamentals indicate that the LGC price should be trading at much higher levels. However, uncertainty is keeping the price suppressed. If we turn on to slide 26 now, this slide, similar to the slide we've presented over the last 2 years, where we outline the challenges for Infigen as identified by market analysts and investors. Much work still needs to be done, but we believe we are making steady progress towards addressing these strategic issues. We are generating strong operating cash flow, and we have been able to meet and slightly exceed our debt amortisation guidance, and we continue to meet our global facility leverage ratio covenant. We're providing more disclosure on the performance of the U.S. business, and you can see that in the MD&A. And we have engaged with investors to ascertain what other information we could provide in what is an inherently complex regulatory structure in the U.S. From an operational perspective, we have retired a key risk in settling the disputes with Gamesa and in executing long-term warranty service and maintenance agreements. We've been able to advance our development pipeline, but we recognize we need to be in a stronger position to meet the expected growth signals in Australia and the U.S. in the coming years. Recently, poor market conditions have meant that we have not been disadvantaged relative to our competitors. We have controlled our wind farm costs by executing post-warranty service and maintenance agreements with Vestas in Australia and with Mitsubishi and Gamesa in the U.S., and implemented effective strategies to control these costs. We also undertook an organization restructure and cost reduction initiative that will deliver a $7 million per annum saving from FY14. While the market will ultimately tell us what our securities are worth, we believe the ongoing focus on addressing the strategic issues above will lead to improving recognition of value. If we turn now to slide 27, the outlook and priorities, we've set out here a summary of our priorities and outlook for FY14 and beyond. We'll continue to publish unaudited quarterly production and revenue with prior corresponding period comparatives. And while we do not guide to these items, we have included some relevant observations in the slide. Our confidence in our ability to manage post-warranty operating costs has meant that we are in a position to guide to a tighter range of operating costs this year. Turning to slide 28, the FY14 operating cost guidance ranges are $73 to $76 million for the US and $35 to $37 million for Australia. We also expect to generate around $80 million of cash available to repay Class A capital balances, interest rate swap terminations previously disclosed, and global facility debt amortisation. A reconciliation of this number to prior periods is also provided in the appendix, slide 37. Thank you. That concludes the formal presentation, and I'd now like to open the floor and lines for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press 0 then 1 on your telephone keypad and be then placed into a queue. That is 0 then 1 on your telephone keypad. And our first question comes from Chris Labbitt from JP Morgan. Chris, please go ahead.
Good morning, guys. Just a quick question on slide 23. I was just looking at your previous presentations and that point of intercept where the LGC balance or the RET target shortfall occurs, which you've now got at 2028, previously was in 2026. And I was just wondering whether you could sort of walk through what's changed in that particular market, and also maybe just touch on how the Clean Energy Finance Corporation may impact that market over the coming years.
Okay. On the chart, I mean, this chart changes all the time, really depending on what new capacity is being built, and other factors. But I guess that's primarily the factor that's driving it. I don't have a good explanation for the 26 to 28 change, unless Richie, you do. But I suspect that's really just driven by the capacity that's been introduced in the intervening period.
Yeah, there's been high hydro levels as well, so they're contributing a bit towards the supply side, and pretty decent wind conditions. So as your capacity factors increase, you get a bit more supply, Chris.
Yeah. On the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, they have supported the development of a number of projects, and clearly that will support additional construction of projects that will contribute to the generation of renewables. But, you know, as we noted in going through this slide, there's a pretty big requirement, something like 3 to 4 gigawatts required to date from what we've seen of what the Clean Energy Finance Corporation has done, although that will account for part of that construction, there's still a huge task ahead.
Very Very good. Thank you very much, guys.
And thank you for the question. Our next question comes to the line of John Heasy from Deutsche Bank. John, please go ahead.
Oh, good morning, everyone. Miles, I was wanting to see if you had an update regards to the Capital Wind Farm, where you had indicated previously that you were looking at options for divesting that. So if you can update us on that process, please.
Sure. We announced some time ago, for those who may not have seen it, we announced some time ago that we were conducting some market testing just around the possibility to sell an Australian asset, and in particular the Capital Wind Farm. That process is ongoing. There isn't anything to report on that, other than, you know, if and when we have an outcome or something to report, we'll let you know. But for the moment, the process is just continuing.
All right, thank you. Another question, if I may. In regards to, you made mention of the issues surrounding the impending election, and what engagement have you had with the current opposition, and how do you see the RET going on the other side of the election if the opposition were to be elected the government? How do you see that playing out?
Okay, that's a big topic, but I'll try to address it sort of relatively briefly. As I mentioned, there has been a lot of lobbying, particularly by existing coal and gas-fired generators, to reduce the renewable energy target, primarily because that's affecting their profitability, as evidenced by the recent announcement, for example, of Energy Australia's performance for the year. So renewable energy is actually affecting their profitability because it's driving down wholesale prices, particularly in South Australia, as well evidenced there. The renewable energy target, as you know, was reviewed by the current government late in 2012, and the current government endorsed the outcome. The legislation has always had bipartisan support, including the increase to the target that was agreed in 2009-2010. We have had a lot of discussion, John, with coalition MPs about the renewable energy target. Now, that target is due to be reviewed under the current legislation again between July 14 and December 14. But the coalition have said that they want to review it anyway. There's a couple of reasons for wanting to do that, and I suppose if they're going to review it, we would prefer they did it earlier rather than later. The first is really to settle once and for all what the target should be. And there has been many commitments from the coalition that they do not intend to scrap the RET, firstly. Secondly, that they support the 20% number, the 20% by 2020. And more recently, the Parliamentary Secretary, the Shadow Parliamentary Secretary for Climate Action, Simon Birmingham, has confirmed that the coalition supports the 41,000 gigawatt hour absolute target of the large scale scheme. Now, that was pretty widely reported a couple of weeks ago. And we know from our discussions with coalition members that that statement wasn't just Simon's little frolic. It actually has broad coalition support. So why are they reviewing the target? I guess we have appealed to them, as have others, that there's a number of deficiencies in the current legislation, some of which are identified in the Climate Change Authority's report. In particular, having a scheduled biennial review of the legislation just adds to uncertainty. Government always has an opportunity to review any legislation whenever it likes. Our preference would be to remove scheduled reviews altogether and just rely on that power. But as a minimum, what from discussions we've had, we're expecting that the coalition will at least extend substantially that review period. They will also look at, again, at the absolute target level and whether that's appropriate in the current market. We are not concerned about that further review, in the sense that if it's based on facts, then the same facts that led to the Climate Change Authority's outcome are likely to lead any other reputable consultant agency to come to the same conclusion. So I think we're stuck with a review. They're committed to undertaking the review. As you know, the Liberal Party and the coalition more broadly is a broad church, as John Howard used to say. There are people within the coalition who for other reasons have concerns about the renewable energy target. I guess all I can say to date is that the indications are favourable from discussions with people in the coalition who are likely to be in that decision-making role, but it is clearly a risk.
Thanks, Miles.
And thank you for the question. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press 0 then 1 on your telephone keypad and be then placed into a queue. That is 0 then 1 on your telephone keypad. And ladies and gentlemen, just another reminder, if you do have a question or a follow-up question, please press 0 then 1 on your telephone keypad.
Okay, well, if there are no further questions, I'd just like to thank you for participating in this call this morning. And as always, if you have some follow-up questions, please feel free to call Richie Farrell, our Investor Relations Manager, or myself as appropriate. Thank you for participating this morning.